This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you ka-ching. Ka-ching. Come on, guys, we talked about this. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And once you start selling, Shopify makes getting paid simple by instantly accepting every type of payment. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. You want to grow big? Shopify. You want to grow small? Shopify. You want to grow medium rare? Also Shopify. Shopify powers 10% of all commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is iFanboy Booksplode, Avengers Kree Skrull War. Fanboy Booksplode, Avengers Kree Skrull War. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and I am here with Josh Flanagan.
You find you're having trouble saying Kree Skrull, huh?
Kree Skrull.
Kree Skrull.
I don't want to say skull.
Yeah.
So I'm really hitting the R.
Well, you know, you're doing the hard work for those of the listeners out there, and they need to know it.
Welcome to Booksplode, our bi-monthly review show, in which we review a graphic novel, collected edition, some sort of giant book every other month. It was unlocked by the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy. Thank you for being patrons, and I guess spoilers for this, and just so you point of reference, Josh and I both read the Avengers Kree Skrull War Gallery Edition, which is the big oversized hardcover that Marvel put out a couple years ago. So if we refer to page numbers, those are the pages in the Gallery Edition, and I apologize if you don't have that one.
I believe that if something is 50 years old, you do not have to issue spoiler warnings.
You'd think that.
I'm saying that for me is the rule I'm going to go with.
All right.
That's what I'm saying, but I'm actually very considerate.
So Avengers Kree Skrull War went through issues of Avengers 89 through 97, taking place through the month and year of June 1971 to March 1972, written by Roy Thomas with art by Sal Buscema and then Neil Adams and then a little bit of John Buscema. You know, one thing we've said over the years at iFanboy is that we've read a lot of the 60s Marvel books, obviously, the where it sort of started, Marvel being Marvel, and we grew up in the 80s, so 80s, 90s, 2000s, and beyond, we've all read those. But the hole in our fandom is really the 70s. We just haven't read a lot of 70s comics from Marvel comparatively to the other decades. And even we tried to do one, we did The Death of Captain Marvel, turned out that was from 1980. But this is purely early 70s, post-Kirby Lee, and now you're into the sort of the second wave. Interesting from that point of view for me, because you just haven't read a lot from that era.
Roy Thomastown.
Yeah, this is Roy Thomastown.
Stan's boy.
Roy was Stan Lee's assistant. Did you read the essay at the beginning?
Yes.
So he took over a bunch of books that Stan didn't want to or couldn't write anymore. One of them was Avengers. One of the things I found interesting from that essay, and who knows, take it with a grain of salt. It's all It could all be myth-making. Who knows? But, you know, this wasn't designed to be a big story. It was just another story in the Avengers. It wasn't even like, you know, you'd open it up and it'd be like Kree-Skrull War Part 3. It was just what it was over these issues as how comics were told back then. It just so happens that in the future, you know, he's sort of looking back on the importance of it, it becomes a thing. But at the time, it was just another arc. And sometimes the Kree-Skrull War would fall. See, I did it. The Kree-Skrull War would fall into the background while something else was happening. So it really was a look into the old-time Marvel storytelling style that we talk about in the show a lot. And we love, I found myself really enjoying it for many reasons, but also, you know, just to see how they did it in a way they just don't do it anymore. And it was really kind of fun to see how these days when so many big stories fall flat, maybe it's because they're so worried about them being big and not worried about them being good. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting while reading this.
So you know how really the story of this has been, you know, when we started doing iFanboy a really long time ago, I think that I sort of lacked the ability to understand how to appreciate a lot of the stories from the past. And I understand that. I understand why now. It can be really difficult to understand the things in the context that they're in and to sort of understand that, like, the reason that the verbiage is anachronistic, you know, it's just one part of it. It's part of what it was like at the time. But also you're seeing boundaries get broken that you don't necessarily have the context for as a younger person who hasn't spent decades thinking about everything you can about mainstream comics. Right. And so, you know, with this, that was not the case. Because while I found myself very much enjoying the Neil Adams art, I spent much of the time hoping that Roy Thomas would just get on with it.
I mean, that's the thing. Is there really isn't anything it to get on with, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah.
If this was happening today, it would be Kree-Skrull War Part 1, the war would start, and then it would be nothing but that for six issues. But this is almost more of a layering in of this conflict between the Krees and the Skrulls that's happening around the Avengers as the Avengers get pulled into it.
Well, I think the first thing that he says in his essay is like, well, there wasn't really a plan for this. We're making it as we go along. And I was like, that much is clear. But actually, when I say get on with it, I understand very clearly that this wasn't plotted out in a long-term way to be a three-act story with, you know, this, this, and this. But like, there are literally scenes where I was like, just get on with it. I don't know why, but this time through, like, it really got to me that like every single character, we had to read everything they thought. And I felt like Roy Thomas was really leaning into, like, I'm going to do Stan Lee, but double it.
Oh, yeah. He was a Stan Lee acolyte.
I know. But, it really stood out to me in a way that I don't know if I've read a ton of it. Obviously, I'm familiar with Roy Thomas, and he does a thing really well. But, like, some of it, there's something to be said for brevity here, and there was none of it.
Oh, see, I had the opposite reaction. I loved every moment of every word balloon, every repeating of a character name and power, the opposite of what we get now, where you can read an entire comic and never know who the names of the people are in the book.
Yeah.
I just loved the way this is and kind of wish comics were still like this.
Yeah, I mean, I've read others where that's sort of not the case, but I, for some reason, like, getting through this felt kind of difficult in that sense.
And then Roy Thomas is a polarizing figure in that sense, because he wasn't Stan. He was trying to be Stan. And then later writers would, you know, take the edges off. But he's really just trying to be Stan here.
Yeah.
And missing that flair that Stan had.
Yeah. And I think that it kind of, there were bits of it where it kind of just felt like, I mean, there's something attractive about the idea that, like, they're not, they're really winging a prayer. They're flinging stuff out there. The references are, like, they either are very dated or they don't make any sense. And I was like, I just felt like I could see this coming from a young person. Mm-hmm. Like, it reminded me of the early 2000s, late 90s, Kevin Smith era of movies, which at the time, you know, we were way into it, you know, in the referential stuff and sort of like, hey, this is where we are. But in this, like, I noticed it. I was like, oh, this is the same thing as that, but happening back then. So I know I led with that, which was, you know, kind of a gag, you know, but there's a lot to appreciate. And there's a lot that I did appreciate very much, but I did find some of it to be laborious for me.
So Roy Thomas was 31
when
the story starts.
And 31 in 1971 was basically 60.
Right. He had 15 kids and a grandkid. Yeah.
He had a mortgage. It was only $45.
I found it interesting that, you know, the main crux of the story on Earth is very similar to what we've been dealing with in comics now, which is the anti-alien crusade. Mm-hmm. Anti-alien crusade being a stand-in for any number of political things at the time in the 70s. And it's basically the same story we're reading now. What are we reading it now in?
We just read that
Superman.
In the Superman Brainiac.
Yeah, Superman. It's the same story. Aliens go home. some demagogic politician taking advantage of and xenophobia.
H. Warren Craddock.
Right. Well, I kept waiting to be revealed to be a Skrull. Did that happen?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, right. He's the fourth one.
Yeah, he was the fourth one. And, right. And you know, when the Intelligence Supreme... By the way, now I've thought every... I was like, wait, has it always been the Intelligence Supreme?
No, at some point it swapped.
Is the pizza... Is it a pepperoni supreme or is this supreme? I don't know. Everything's backwards from what it is. Yeah, he's when he basically does his deus ex machina.
That's right. I forgot about that.
First to everything. And the whole time I was waiting for him, I was like, this guy's clearly a Skrull.
Right. And that's also not, I mean, these are all time-honored things. Sure. That's the fun thing about reading comics. So you can see the echoes of it. Even in DC, where they did the Legend story right after Crisis, where they had a demagogic, not when it was a media member, but he was whipping up anti-superhero sentiment in that book. You know, considering it happens over and over in real life, just not with superheroes. It's not surprising it happens over and over in superhero comics. But before we get to the art, which I think there's a lot to talk about, I found myself really liking, A, that they took this throwaway moment from the second issue of Fantastic Four and turned it into a major plot point of the book.
Yes.
In the Fantastic Four number 2, the first time we see Skrulls, they defeat them. Mr. Fantastic showing some very early signs of what he would do later on in books like Civil War, hypnotizing them into thinking they're cows. And so they're going to live the rest of their lives as cows. But for some reason, Kirby only drew 3 of them in the final panel instead of 4. And so they took that little like no prize moment and turned it into an actual plot point. I think that's a great example of taking something from the past and mining it for a new story. I thought that was really fun.
And the first time I ever heard of that was that Grant Morrison went and picked that up and did the Skrull Kill Crew.
Right.
Which I don't think I've ever read, but I remember somebody explained it to me once forever, like pre-iFanboy, like, oh, so there was this thing where, you know, there was cows and whatever, and I just thought, that's crazy. Isn't the Skrull Kill Crew is like, they ground them up and somebody ate, they ate hamburgers made from those cows? I think that's what that was.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it's sort of in the same thing in that tradition. I think one of the things that stood out for me, and I am definitely trying to put myself in the context of having read this at the time, I thought, you know, this was probably a hell of a lot more fun reading them as they came out issue by issue. And you were like, Christ, what's going to happen next? Because there were all of these things that are still around. I mean, this is the story where the Vision starts to have feelings for Wanda and what that sort of means. And, you know, by the time we got into comics, that was already an established thing. You know, and it was still like, we're weird, but I can imagine at the time that was probably really, really exciting to sort of, you know, and maybe not excited, like, oh, I'm so excited about this, but just, wow, that's nuts. You know, and it was so, it worked so well that, you know, they dealt with it for 30 years. You know, the story culminates 20 years after that with Master Pandemonium. You know, what's funny is that this is one of the first times, like, I kind of understood the original sin of the Inhumans. Basically, if you're reading this, the Inhumans, of course, were humans that the Kree came to Earth millennia earlier, and they took some, we'll say cavemen. I think you could say cavemen and not offend anybody. I feel like that's you don't need to make that.
You don't really hear a lot of complaints from the cavemen.
Right, exactly. So they take the cavemen and they evolutionize them up, and that's how you get the Inhumans, and that's sort of where they're from. And so in a way, the Inhumans were like sleeper agents, and the Kree came back and they made a deal with Maximus to sort of like take over, and then you'll be our foot soldiers on Earth. And Black Bolt walks in on it. And that's with the first time that he uses his power. And in doing so, he drives his brother insane with the power of his voice. And that's how he becomes Maximus the Mad. And I was like, I never knew that.
Right.
And it's great. Again, that story, you know, is still there. You know, and we've seen Maximus in all sorts of different versions, as well you should through then. But great little Inhuman story in the middle of this. I thought that was one of my favorite parts.
If you think about it, like, this is less than 10 years after the creation of the Marvel Universe, right? Mm-hmm. We've been doing iFanboy way longer than these books existed after Fantastic Four number 1. Mm-hmm. And so if they're still figuring it out, they're putting in foundational stuff here that gets used later.
And in that way, the sort of speed of development that the art form, and I can even say the art form like within mainstream superhero American comics, like the way that that art form is developing over this 10 years and then the 10 years that come after it is amazing. Like, it's leaps and bounds.
Okay, let's talk about the art for a minute. So, like, you know, I love the Buscemas. John Buscema is one of the all-time greats, you know, especially from How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way. Everyone of a certain age tried to draw like him for a long time. Sal is really good, too. I've always liked Sal's work. Sal drew a lot of Avengers books that I read as a kid. Mm-hmm. They're also, both of them, very much from the Kirby school.
Yeah, that was very apparent.
You've got a writer who is from the Lee school, and you got two artists who are from the Kirby school. And so it feels very much like a certain kind of comic. And then I was trying to put myself in the mindset of someone in 1971 who opens the page on that first Neil Adams book and doesn't completely lose their minds.
I kind of lost my mind.
It's like an evolutionary leap, right?
It's Jimi Hendrix, you know, or like late Beatles compared to early Beatles.
And again, the Buscemas are great, but it's just the style is so different. It's naturalistic. It's overwrought. It's melodramatic. Buscemas are also overwrought and melodramatic, but it's in a much more realistic way. Even now, opening the page up and, you know, the first big splash page of, I think it's The Vision.
The Vision. It's his face in the foreground.
I was like, holy shit. I couldn't even imagine if I was, you know, 12 years old in 1971 seeing that. Like, I just would have lost my mind.
I mean, it's almost like, so there's all that beautiful dynamism and grandeur that takes place in the Sal Buscema stuff, but it feels a little bit like going and looking at Simon and Kirby's Captain America number one.
Right.
And then seeing what Kirby then goes on to do. Even like early Fantastic Four Kirby, that's not full Kirby. Like, he's not there. But the leap that we take when we go to Adams, it's like they gave movies different lenses and angles and positions to shoot from.
Well, it's like when the camera could finally move on a movie set, right?
Right.
The camera used to just be locked down. And so you have, it was all, movies were all static shots. And suddenly if a camera's moving, that's like kind of what this is. It's a whole new visual language.
It really felt like all of a sudden, where there felt like there was nothing wrong with the Buscema stuff. I was very much enjoying it. I really like the way that this version of the book has reproduced the colors, mm-hmm. errors and all. But as we sort of moved into the Adams stuff, it was like everything came to life. Things
right.
became flexible. The panel borders changed. We were able to work with scale. First of all, like that shot of the scale of the Vision compared to Ant-Man as he's coming in. It just, I was like, I've never seen a page.
Are you talking about the two-page spread?
The two-page spread.
I'm obsessed with this spread. Like, I keep looking back at it. It's the title page, A Journey to the Center of an Android, and Vision's having problems. So Ant-Man is going to go into the body and fix him. And Cap has holding Ant-Man, and he releases them onto his face. And we're right up over the brow. Cap's eyes are just popping out from above the mouth. Ant-Man's walking on his lip.
And the drawings are excellent.
Can you imagine seeing that in 1971?
I would love to have experienced that. You know what I mean? I kind of did here. Like, I understand it, but I can't have lived it.
You know what? It's like my mom tells me a story of seeing Star Wars opening night. Mm-hmm. And how it was just like nothing else anyone had ever seen before. And it's kind of like that.
So there's a precursor to that. Is that, so in the pages before it, by the way, and they really should have kept the original dialogue when the Vision comes in there. I was shot down by three cows. You got to read the essay at the end of it. The new
yes,
essay,
that was right? good.
It would have been amazing. It's such a modern joke, by the way.
Yeah.
That even the wacky people at Marvel were like, that's too far. So on the page before the splash page, we see that Ant-Man is there. And this, after Ant-Man is introduced in the middle of the one page, which here is page 86, the next two panels of the page are shot as if the camera is at Ant-Man's level, basically. What Adams does here is it isn't just that he shows you like one thing is big and one thing is small. He changes our perspective.
Right.
I talk about this a lot because I really like when comic books do scale, because we can do it in such a way that it's kind of better than most other medium. But when that happens, media when it does it. But I was like, oh, he's playing with the camera angle. He's not just foreshortening, like he's bringing us down to the level so that it's not just that you see that there's size difference between these. You see that from the perspective of Ant-Man down there, they seem gigantic. And then, you know, then he ramps it up another huge step when you go to that double page spread. And you're like, wow, they talked about that for a while. But it was a moment.
Right.
It was a moment, I think, not just for us. I mean, Neil Adams had been working before this. But, you know, if that is what the Avengers looked like, and then this is what it looks like. And these pages, for the most part, the Neil Adams pages, these look like pages would have looked all through the 80s, maybe 90s, early 90s. You know, they look as modern as any of that in sort of their...
Well, yeah, you talk about transformational creators throughout the years. He's certainly one who changed the way everyone tried to make their books look, and in the same way that Brian Hitch did that in 2000.
And it isn't a case of like, you know, like they came along and blew away everything that Kirby did. And so that people forgot. It's not that. It's that he took the things that Kirby did and he said, you could do that, but do it like this a little bit too. You know, and it's standing on the shoulders of giants rather than reinventing the wheel. You know, like Jimi Hendrix plugged in a wah and a fuzz pedal into gigantic Marshall amps. I said martial arts. Marshall amps, you know, but what he was playing was still just blues.
Right. Well, everybody iterates on what came before.
Yeah, no, I know. But like there's certain people that come along and like the first time that you saw David Aja you know, in the Hawkeye book, I was like, I don't know what this is. I mean, like, there's Mazzucchelli in there, there's whatever.
Right.
But this is, you can at least see the lineage. You can be like, okay, he totally respects
him
before.
Like I said, you know, Adams' stuff is always so overwrought and like melodramatic, but also that's in the Buscemas, which means it was in Kirby as well. Yes. I mean,
yep.
There's one early shot that I loved where somebody backhands Quicksilver and he comes flying at the camera. This is a Sal Buscema page. And it's beautiful. His body language, he's like in half. Mm. It's the same thing. It's just a different style. One thing I did find interesting about the Neil Adams pages is, and I've read a lot of Neil Adams drawn comics in my life, sure. Mostly from later on. But, you know, we all know the famous panels, but there's also a lot of like workaday panels in here.
Yes.
Because he clearly didn't have the time to put the full effort into all the panels. So he sort of picked and choosed which ones were going to be like really impressive versus,
yeah.
Versus not. So if you go to Josh, if you go to page 26, when the robot just smacks Pietro, who quite frankly deserves several smacks.
Absolutely.
And he's flying at us. Yeah. He's upside down. His face is writhing in pain. Like that is a Buscema page. That is straight out of How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way. That panel, I mean.
I like that the lettering goes up the side. Yeah, but it's like it's twisted.
Pietro's a bit of a misogynist, by the way.
Well, I mean, like I've been sort of slowly going through Mad Men again.
Yeah.
And this is not quite contemporary to it. It's about 10 years off, actually. But a lot of it in here was like, oh, she's just having one of her womanly fits. And I was like, is this supposed to be ironic? Or
no.
I don't think it is.
No, it's not.
It's a little rough. Like, I was like, boy, Jan really gets the short shrift in this. And that's not counting the worst thing that happens to her.
Right.
That was also a little like, ooh, that, like, a lot of that isn't aging well. It's very like men standing around like, we know what is happening. It's one of a womanly disposition such as thou canst know. It became very obvious to me in this. I was like, boy, I've gone along with Thor and how he talks for a long time and I love it. But in this, I was like, you know what? I think this makes no sense. This is just bad Shakespearean. And it's always been the case. But it's just like, it's almost like Roy Thomas was trying too hard.
Oh, I think that's true. And I like Roy Thomas. When I was a kid, I bought a ton of those Roy Thomas Invaders books. I like him a lot, but he was definitely at this point, you know, trying really hard to be Stan Lee instead of being himself. Mm-hmm. One of the things I really liked about the book, story-wise, was it had that Marvel thing where it really felt like a larger world. You know, so many books now are sort of locked into their boundaries. You know, these are the characters and this is all. But, like, the story here features the Avengers, the Inhumans, the Fantastic Four. A bunch of people just come in and out of the story.
Annihilus shows up.
And Carol Danvers shows up as part of Captain Marvel, who shows up. It just feels like you're in this larger world where things are happening. There's a lot of characters.
I mean, you're right. There really is a sense of like you drop into some characters.
Yep.
I remember this. It is one of the things I really loved about comics. And it happens now, but it doesn't happen the same. Because we were talking about this on our normal show recently, you know. People make their own little universe. They'll take a bunch of characters and like specifically I'm thinking of like Jed McKay does that right now.
Right.
And so like he's writing Strange and Moon Knight and
Avengers.
Black Cat and whatever and Avengers and like they all get together, but it's more planned, it's more structured. Whereas, you know, this Nick Fury kind of shows up.
All right, Nick Fury, that's what I was thinking of.
Nick Fury shows up at one point earlier, very briefly, to be like, all right, I got to do my duty. I don't really want to. And then, you know, he becomes crucial to a thing that happens later. But they're not huge cameos. He's just passing through, kind of. And then he helps get things moving and you get a sense of who he is and what he's doing. And it's nice, but it's small. It's not huge team up.
The first time you saw Nick Fury, he doesn't have an eye patch. And then 2 pages later, he does.
He was also on the moon, which gave me a shudder.
But, you know, you're right. It just felt like these characters were just sort of zooming by in the background. And it felt like when you read comics back then, people were always calling Reed Richards up for scientific advice. Mm-hmm. You feel like he was just constantly answering FaceTime calls in his lab. It doesn't really happen now. Everyone's sort of blocked off. I just randomly opened the page up where Triton is coming out of the water.
Great page.
And I was like, oh, jeez.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's crazy. It is really crazy. You have Iron Man with his roller skates. Like this is sort of hits all the right buttons for this period.
I had no idea this is where Iron Man with roller skates came from. One of Ron, our iFanboy founding partner, Ron's favorite panels, and I'd seen it many times and referred to. I did not know it was in the story. And further, and more importantly, I did not know it was Neil Adams.
Also, I did not know that those discs on his hips were the power supply for the suit.
I believe that changes depending on... I think that's a hard and fast rule.
And we're not talking about the story because, like I said, it's not like a focused war story. It's more of a conflict. It would be more appropriate to call the Kree Skrull conflict, because it's more like these two races hate each other and they're threatening to fight. And it doesn't really come into being the main thing until like the very end, like the last two issues.
And it doesn't start or end in this. It's the Avengers have to deal with some stuff.
Because Captain Marvel gets pulled into it.
Right. And so like they have to wade into it, but you know, it's an eons long thing and they're not solving any problems here. It's not the beginning of it. We're dropping into it and dropping out of it, which is interesting because now everything has to have the, like, you know, when a few years ago, like the tree aliens show up and they will have their revenge.
Right.
And the whole thing is about, you know, that beginning and ending, which is the thing that makes you feel like you're part of a larger world because, you know, when you're walking down the street and some shit's going on, you know, you see a part of it. You don't see the whole thing. And that's sort of what it's like. It's very New York City, actually, in a way.
Would you prefer this version of Clint Barton or the current one in comics?
Well, if we're going to get to this now. So Clint Barton, who we all know is Hawkeye, or should, if you don't, I'm sorry, is Goliath in this. And they actually refer to Goliath at one point. And I was like, I wonder who that's going to, you know.
Yeah.
I thought they were just talking about Ant-Man, but no, it wasn't. And he's Goliath, because for a brief time in the early 70s, I guess he'd abandoned Hawkeye. I don't remember why.
It's not brief. It's like 30 issues or 35 issues.
Well, it's not brief enough. I know that much.
He became Goliath in Avengers 63. And I believe from what I read, the very next issue, not in this collection, he goes back to being Hawkeye.
Ah, I could have dealt with that.
Which is better than being left for dead, because that's what happens in this book. Because like, oh, is he dead?
I don't know how well established his character was at this point, but I did feel like he was one of the characters who just talked like the other character. Like
they all say fella.
He spoke exactly like Ant-Man, who spoke pretty much exactly like Rick Jones. Cap's different. It's almost like Roy Thomas didn't know what to do with Cap to a certain extent, but at least he was unique, as was sort of Iron Man. But all the other characters just sort of talked like that. And so I was kind of looking for Clint Barton in there. I was looking for Hawkeye in there, but I didn't really see much of him.
He was called High Pockets at one point.
Yeah, he did. I noticed that and I enjoyed it. But let's be honest, you know, Hank Pym is High Pockets, but only half the time when he's Short Pockets. But what I was going to say, though, is that the one thing I did notice is that I was like, how big is he supposed to be?
Right, he kept changing.
Almost for a while, I was like, does he not get small again? Is he just stay big?
Right, because he would sort of be giant in like really awkward places, like in the in the mansion or in like a ship.
Yeah, and then there was like, oh, I forgot to take my serum. And then at one point, and I don't really know why, it's from out of nowhere, he kind of goes, that's it, I said I was taking the last of the serum. And I was like, why? And you know there's not like another book where that's happening. This is just happening here. And you just like, he had some sort of like come to Jesus moment, but it was off screen and we'll never know why. Well, he's like, are there addictive properties? Is there something like, is there something wrong with your balls? Why is this happening?
It's a kidney problem.
So I was happy like, oh, we get Hawkeye in this. But I was like, not really. He could have been anybody.
Right. So the team here is Cap, Thor, Iron Man, Quicksilver, Scarlet Witch, Goliath. Ant-Man is on the team in the beginning and he quits almost immediately because he feels like he's more effective in the lab. And then the Vision. That seems to be the team. Captain Marvel is here, but not on the team. But he is a major part of the story and in every issue and, you know, on the cover of most of them or a lot of them. And then Rick Jones, obviously their mascot, is a big part of the story as well. At this point, Captain Marvel and Rick Jones are entangled. They do the whole switcheroo thing. And this is where it's revealed that Rick Jones has some latent power that's not really dealt with again until Kurt Busiek's Avengers Forever story.
But I felt like the idea was that we all have, like, it's within all humanity. It's just that the Supreme Intelligence unlocked it in him.
I'm sorry, Intelligence Supreme.
Yeah, the Intelligence. It's just like a burrito. Just remember it that way. He doesn't not look like a burrito you stepped on. It's interesting when you talk about all those characters is that I felt like one of the things happening here is that there wasn't like a lot of character development, which, you know, may or may not be good or bad. But I thought about like there's a lot of Vision character development here. While many of the characters around them tend to remain ciphers, there's character development for Rick Jones. And I don't know how you don't love Rick Jones. I really kind of wish that Rick Jones was still around, like as still a major character.
Right. Whenever he shows up, he's just kind of bitter.
Yeah, like it'd be cool if he was. They should bring back Rick Jones.
Right.
After reading this, if I had to pitch anything to Marvel, I'd be like, let's do an awesome Rick Jones story. But like not bitter, not old, not what it just.
I don't know, the last time we saw him was in that throwback Marvel book, right? Genesis? Or
maybe, yeah. Well, the last time
we saw him in the
Peter David's Maestro story.
The Maestro story as well. It makes sense that the Vision would be the one because he'd only been around at this point for about 30 issues, 40 issues.
Well, what's great, though, is that, like, the character that was forming here is the character, like, this is the natural outgrowth of the character who I got to know.
Right.
that's like, oh, this is the Vision. This is the beginning of that Vision character who stayed consistent and became the one, you know, that does learn to be a human. It finds his place. This is all things about, you know, like, can I feel, you know, am I a human? What am I, you know, and he sort of gets through that. And I was like, I miss Vision, man.
Yeah. He was always one of my favorite Avengers, always.
Yeah. Because of that. Because not just a robot.
He also has a terrific visual style, and they just won't go back to that classic Vision costume for whatever reason, but I just love that green and yellow with the red face Vision.
Did you notice that at one point, like, his head was yellow, and I was like, wait a minute, is this wrong? And then, like, the next issue, his head was green again. I was like, oh,
somebody fucked up.
I love that they kept the error. I assume it was like that in the original books, and I
this
want them
particular
to keep-
collection, and I know you've got problems I don't disagree with, but... Just from the art side, it's a gorgeous reproduction.
It's a beautiful reproduction. It's oversized so that you really see, you know, all the stuff that's going into it. It's really lovely. It's interesting because if you know anything about printing.
And he does. Here we go.
No. They put basically a border on the outside of each of the pages because comic book aspect ratio is actually incredibly unique. It's this weird, like, you know, there's like 5x8 and whatever. Like, the comic book aspect ratio is very strange. It's right. Many decimals long to get to exactly what it is. It's a very specific shape and is not standardized. So when you're doing large-scale book printing, they'd have to custom cut that and it would cost a lot more. So in this, they put those borders on the edge. But what they also did was put the pages right in the gutter of a hardcover non-lay flat book. And so, like, it's kind of hard to see what's happening in the middle. And so when there's a double page spread, this is more problematic in the beginning and the end.
You could have halved the size of the gutter and centered the pages.
Yes. I think there would have been a way to do that.
You know what? This is also something I thought of. So on the side borders, they have on one side, they have a scroll. So they have a Kree. It's from an image in the book where they're facing off against each other.
Yeah. Kree doesn't look like any other Kree I've ever seen.
No. I was kind of hoping they would be like, what do you call it? When you flip the pages and they move.
Yeah.
It's the same static pose. I just was hoping that I'd flip it and they would,
I was thinking like maybe every 20, 30, 40 pages, switch them around. Put a different guy there. Different scroll, different Kree. Or at least a Kree who looks like a Kree. Because that dude, I'm a guy who knows a thing or two about Marvel Comics, right?
Right.
Like, I'm not just some nobody. I mean, I am a nobody, but, like, you know, I know some things. If you showed me that picture.
Right.
I would never be like, that's a Kree.
Nope.
I know it's a Skrull.
I've never seen a Kree wear a yellow bodysuit with green boots and
he looks like one of the guys who helps train Prince Adam.
Right.
That's what he looks like.
Yeah, it's not.
Maybe a Titan or an Eternal. That doesn't read Kree to me in any way.
I also found it funny that, you know, the Skrulls look like they do. You know, they have those weird chins and giant ears and they look kind of like apes, but not the ladies.
I was going to say,
the ladies are hot. They just look like regular ladies with green skin.
Not only is the lady hot, but she's into Mar-Vell.
Well, wouldn't you be? He's like a silver fox.
Her dad is the emperor of all Skrees, and she's like, yeah, but look at that dude. And I was like, dude, he's not a nice dad. You need to watch your ass.
Also, what is Nick Fury wearing on page 165? He's got white pants, black boots, a black t-shirt tucked in with a space symbol on his breast.
I'm not there, but I'm very excited about what you're saying.
It's a space uniform, clearly, because he's in his satellite.
He's in a Kirk chair. I mean, he's clearly in a Kirk chair. I love it. It looks like he's one of the space... His logo is like a space Lego guy.
They should have taken that for the space command, whatever it's called now.
Mm-hmm. Space Force.
Space Force? That should have been their uniform.
Might be.
I'm trying to look for...
That next page is amazing. The ship lifting off. So good.
It's a visual feast. I'm trying to look for... So Carol Danvers is here because she's, you know, still the head of security.
At, quote...
Jarvis gets some fun comedic beats. Like, it just felt like a whole lot was happening. And a whole lot of Marvel characters are here. Mm-hmm. And it's all whizzing by you pretty fast. And not in a bad way. It's just like there's a lot going on.
Go back to where you were. So you're at 165. Go to 167. This brings me to something that I thought of as I was reading
it. Hold on.
Now, back then, I figure a lot of people know this, but I'll give you the brief primer. There is ways of writing comics. One of them is referred to as Marvel style. Marvel style came about because supposedly Stan Lee would write a shorter, vaguer synopsis of what it is that happens.
Paragraph synopsis of what
sometimes it's broken up by page. Other times it is not. It is up to the artist to sort of draw what they take in from that, put it into sequential art, and then the writer comes back in and fills in the dialogue or, you know, whatever the words that are that need to be. Now, as I'm reading this, and Roy Thomas does say something at the beginning about the way that he works with Neil Adams is that we sort of became one and it was symbiotic, and I can see it.
Yeah.
As I was reading this, I was like, it's true, because if this isn't being scripted, so we're back at page 167, as the ship is taking off, we're getting a little recap of all the things that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
And Thor is talking about stuff. And then above it, you see flashbacks and then narration of what happened in those places as we go through. And it's a really neat little sequence. And what I thought is, how was this done without scripting it? Because it was scripted to some extent, or they talked about it, worked it out, or Neil thought about how he did it, and he did it in this way, and then left the space for Roy to come back in and complete it. But this is not the product of Marvel style. There's no way. And I love that.
Did you notice in Neil Adams's essay in the back, he referred to Jack Kirby's story in Fantastic Four number 2?
Yes, I didn't. I just took it as rote because that's where I fall on that continuum.
I thought that was interesting.
Yes.
Then I remember Jack Kirby's first Skrull story. I was like, oh, all right, shots fired in a Marvel book.
I know. And at the same time, like, he's with Stan's boy. That's what I call Roy, by the way, Stan's boy. I mean, you can say that you love the Buscemas all you want, but you can't tell me that you didn't get to the last issue and see this by John Buscema and be like, what the fuck?
No, I was excited. I love John Buscema.
Fine, but it's where we were doing a thing. We're in a mode. It's like the main act walked off stage and like, here to finish this up, John Fogerty.
This sort of tells you that, you know, this wasn't a big planned out thing. It's the final issue of this story. The cover, first of all, it's a Gil Kane cover.
Oh, wow.
But it doesn't tell you that it's wrapping up this story. Well, it says the finale of the Skrull Kree War. Okay, it does. Fair enough. But it doesn't express that in the visuals. It's an image of the invaders who are only in this issue for like 2 pages. But you wouldn't know from looking at this cover that this is the end of the story.
That is a terrible drawing of Captain America. That is an outright just terrible Captain America on that cover. And the sequence that is referring to in this made no sense to me at all. I was like, wait, these are the original Marvel characters from 1940.
Yes.
Why? 1938? 9?
The Supreme Intelligence used the power within Rick Jones to conjure up the characters that he was reading about in Marvel Comics earlier in the story.
Which confused me because at least 2 of these characters are real.
Right. He says they're mostly fake. But I was like, does that mean they're saying that the Human Torch? Because I think back then they were trying to say that those characters, but they weren't saying, I don't know.
I don't think the Jim Hammond Human Torch had existed for real in this world yet. Certainly was not a connection to the Vision.
Well, when did the Invaders get
established later?
Published. Because he was definitely in that.
I feel like that was in the 70s.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just looking for when it first happened.
It'd have to be after this.
Their first appearance was 69. Their first appearance was only 2 years earlier.
Maybe it's happening at the same time. He's just trying to drum up sales for his other book.
Not out of the question.
That's the most Marvel thing you could do. Stan would do that.
Invaders was in the 70s for sure. Invaders number 6 was 1976. So you say 75, maybe?
Okay.
He's laying the groundwork.
But yeah, but also just like again, I know what I know. And I was like, Roy Thomas is a fanboy. I'm going to put these in here. And then other fanboys, like back then when that really meant something.
Invaders number 1, 1975, August. And on the cover is Cap, Namor, and Jim Hammond. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's sort of seeing how the reaction is going to be here. But you're totally right. This is the first generation of fans writing.
Yes.
Famously, guys like Stan and Jack and Joe and Ditko, they weren't fans. They were making it up as they went along. And they were kind of annoyed they had to do it in the first place.
They were blue-collar guys who knew they were working on a disposable, unrespected medium.
The next generation, Roy Thomases, loved that shit.
Yeah.
And so then they're basically bringing back the stuff they love. So he's bringing back all the characters from the 40s here.
And if you think about it, like, this is because of that. Again, we can refer back to we can understand this because from, you know, as movie, pop culture, Star Wars fans, when the art of cinema and television decided to reference that stuff and let you know that the people making that stuff also liked the same stuff that you liked directly, it was really thrilling and exciting. As I got older, like, it got less exciting. And this is probably like that. I can imagine if I was a comic book reader, I'd started reading these comics at 12 and now I'm 19, 20, and you start to see this postmodernism.
Plus it's 1971. You're probably super high.
Yeah. And everybody's sleeping with everybody, so you're not worried about that. You can really enjoy stuff.
You can just have fun.
That's how it worked, right?
I think so.
That must have been super exciting. Now, because I'm old and I have context and I know everything, like it has a different effect on me, but I can understand what it is in the context, and that's really fun. And then, of course, you know, what happens is that we get through the 70s and all that cosmic stuff starts up and, you know, other people go, well, let's try to actually tell different kinds of stories. And that's the evolution of the art form, but this little bit has to happen.
I found myself reading that Ant-Man issue where he goes inside the Vision, and I was thinking, this makes no sense for the inside of a robot. Nope. This layout, what's happening in here? Nothing.
I'm really surprised as I read that, that sequence, that issue isn't known better, isn't referenced.
It should be.
More.
It's a visual tour de force.
It was, to me, the sort of centerpiece of the book. And I was like, oh, we're breaking ground here. We're doing amazing things right here. And I feel like, I'm guessing if you were making comics in the 80s, you know, or 90s, that's the thing that people talked about. And I know that there's sequels. Again, I just referred to, you know, David Aja's Hawkeye, you know, like right. That made an, like, this feels like that kind of thing. Like, look what I can do. McFarlane's Spider-Man, that felt like that kind of issue.
Right.
Real taking a big step kind of thing.
I don't want to start a whole thing because we are, I think, wrapping up slowly. But, you know, without opening a can of worms, there's the whole Hank Pym scenario where he was saddled rightly as a character with this tag of being abusive. The whole, you know, famous Hank Pym backhand to Jan when she's trying to help him in the lab and caused a whole kerfuffle for years about whether or not they could get past that or not. Marvel tends to never get past it. They kept bringing it up. They haven't brought it up in a long time again. So I feel like they've kind of moved on Smart. From it, which is fine. That's what happens. But I literally gasped reading this book at one point where Jan is riding on the back of a, is it like a wasp or whatever it is, with Yellow Jacket.
I think it's the Savage Land. They don't call it the Savage Land.
No, it's just a part of the Inhumans. Arctic that the Kree have de-evolved. And then at the end of the story, right. It goes back to ice.
So they're on a big, they're on a bug from that era.
Yeah.
That's
and so they're traveling there and Jan's worried about something and he just turns around and backhands her again and knocks her out. I gasp.
Also, like, it didn't make any sense because his thing was like, I don't want her to go with me because it's not safe. And there's 5,000 other ways than backhand slapping her off a giant bug.
Right.
It was very strange. It's funny because you had said to me, there was a panel or page that made me gasp. I had no idea what you meant. I didn't ask. And I really thought that it was going to be like the Vision lip thing, like right. That page. I thought it was going to be a piece of art. And then I got to that and I went back and forth a few times. I was like, wait, like, he's not hitting her because he's angry.
No.
It's the strangest thing.
Sorry, honey, no time to explain. Smack. Yes. It's just, it's very bizarre.
Backhands are like you would beat somebody in order to keep them safe. And then somebody saw that and was like, I think I can build on this, which is crazy.
Yeah. I'm usually not in favor of not erasing stuff, but just not referring. Like, they should just not be referring to this anymore. And they haven't in a long time. But back in the 2000s, when we were running iFanboy, it was constantly coming up in the Avengers books. And people were, you know, we sort of split the camp in two. And in terms of this is a big deal, this isn't a big deal kind of thing. And
right. And readers grabbed onto it like it was a real thing.
It's just interesting that they made that part of his character.
Right.
And obviously back then things were different and seen differently. This doesn't mean it was good, but they were seen differently. I mean, I remember watching a trailer for The Philadelphia Story, you know, a classic Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, Jimmy Stewart movie. And the big comedic beat in the trailer is when he walks up to Katharine Hepburn, grabs her by the face and shoves her. And it's played for laughs in the trailer, but it's not funny. So
yeah,
what was acceptable in the past is different. But this is something that I think Marvel's better off leaving in the past as a part of Hank's character if they want Hank Pym at all to be usable as a character.
Well, I mean, it could be argued that this broke his character in a way that never recovered from, really. I mean, today they don't know what to do with him. Today Hank Pym's like, he's one step away from Bruce Banner, I think,
the last time
I saw him. I don't know. They don't know what to do with him. So they keep replacing him with other people. You get to the point where the movie is he's not the main character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's Michael Douglas is the retired Hank Pym, and he's a prick. It's very odd.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Quicksilver's horrible misogyny aside. I was always loving the characters. I really was invested in the whole Scarlet Witch Vision, will they, won't they, they almost kiss moment.
That's great.
There was a funny bit there where, like, it turned out it wasn't them, but it was the Skrulls impersonating them, but they were like, founding Avengers only. And I was like, well, Cap, you're not a founding Avenger. You came in issue 4.
That's another thing, too, is that, like, I know that the Skrulls are. So when that weird scene is happening,
like,
I know, oh, those are Skrulls. But if you're not, or you
if you're 9 reading this,
the Skrulls are, or you're 15, who cares? Like, what the? And that ends. I mean, you got to, like, the issue thing is great. It was great then because you're reading this comic, you're into it. And the end of it, Thor, Iron Man, and Cap come in and they just blow up at these people and kick them out of the Avengers. You're like, what the hell? What just happened? It must have been so exciting.
Right. Oh, man. I'm just flipping through this. This is a gorgeous book.
I wanted to mention this one thing. There's a lot of, like, contemporary pop culture references.
Yeah.
And at one point, and I'm trying to find it, and I can't, but somebody's like, who's that? And someone says, it's not the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers.
Right.
Which is a Robert Crumb comic. And it may be Cap who says it. And I was like, no fucking way. Or whoever said it.
No, he was an artist. He was an artist. He might know R. Crumb.
He's not saying it. Well, it doesn't, like, it was such a weird, like, there was, again, there was a lot of, like, I think, actually, I really liked it, but when Hank Pym goes in, he's got ants with him, and they're...
Peter, Paul, and Mary?
No, Crosby, Stills, and Young.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash, that's right, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. And I was like, oh, wow, they 100% use that in Paul Rudd Ant-Man. That is a thing that character would have said, right. And I really like... In fact, he named his ants. I was like, oh, it's kind of... I hope there's a direct line, but if not, it's still being set there. But there were a lot of sort of pop culture references that felt to me like, hey, the kids will like if we refer to this, you know?
Oh, for sure.
And that Fabulous Furry Free Brothers thing is like, we're cool, you know? And again, it had never been done before,
right,
in comics is my guess, and so therefore it would have been exciting, and it would have made you feel like the college kids would have been like, oh, man, they understand me.
It feels like you're in a club.
Yeah.
In the same way that, and people younger than us won't get it, when Kevin Smith referenced the Star Wars in the early 90s, this was before Star Wars had a renaissance, we felt like, oh, shit, this is a guy who's part of our, you know, wavelength.
Mid-90s, yeah, okay. Clerks is 96, I think.
90?
Yeah.
Was it 96? Nope. 94.
Nope, 94, you're right, 94. Yeah. 94 is the year.
So that was, you know, only a few years after the Zahn books.
Reservoir Dogs, 92. They're sitting around the table at the beginning, and they're talking about the Fantastic Four, and there's a couple of other comic book things in there. Like, that had never... That had never happened.
Right.
Like, Connor and I took a class on this in college. Right. I'm not kidding. Like, the postmodernism in media, and it was a brand new thing.
Right.
In mainstream movie TV. And you're seeing them do it here, and possibly inventing it here in a way, or, you know, at least legitimizing it here in these comic books. And I think that's really cool.
So I had a lot of fun reading this. Rating it, it's different. This is not like a complete story. We're literally dipping in for however many issues it is. 8? And dipping out again. And it just so happens that these are the stories that deal with the Kree Skrulls. But, you know, now you get a start, the story ends. There's no sense of continuity between the arcs. And so, you know, you're not getting a 3-act structure, as you said earlier in the show. So I'm rating this on how I felt reading it. And how I felt reading it was super fun. I'm rating it 4.75 out of 5.
Wow. Oh, it's very hard. Because the thing is... At times, reading it, the actual, like, words were kind of a struggle for me. But I'm really glad I read it, and I think it's really important, and I really enjoyed great parts of it. And I really liked talking about it and understanding it and putting it in context. This conversation was worth it.
Yes.
In that way.
Again, this is a whole, right? Everyone who reads these comics has heard of the Kree-Skrull War.
Yeah.
I never read it.
Yeah.
And so this was a hole. The 70s still remain a hole. I'd like to find some more books from the 70s to read. I'd like to see the evolution of Roy Thomas and how the books in the late 70s are different from the books in the early 70s. So it was very valuable in that sense. It was valuable to see the changeover from Buscema to Adams. It was cool to see the characters in this moments, again, less than 10 years after they're created.
One thing I love is understanding the timeline of comics and the development of, you know, this art form. And this sort of universe and everything. And this is an amazing sort of bit of historical, like, okay, wait a minute. You're doing the history. You're all understanding right. How it all developed. 4.3.
All right.
With that.
I like being back in that Marvel style, you know, just the way that the soap opera flows. So there you go. There's Avengers Kree-Skrull War. There's many volumes and collections of it. This is just one of them. That's a beautiful
oversized
version.
If you are going to get it, get the oversized one. It's absolutely worth it. I thank my good friend Connor for sending it along to me, because you might think, boy, they were really up Neil Adams' ass about that art. We could have devoted more time to talking about it. I could open up any page and talk about it for probably 5-10 minutes.
Yes, for sure.
I bet.
For sure. I picked it up at Iced Up Comics, our good friend James Syme store in San Francisco, and I saw it on the shelf, and I was like, oh, shit. And I was like, that's an oversized Kree-Skrull War. I've never read that before. And so I got it. And that's how we got here. Thanks for listening. You can go to ifanboy.com. You can find Josh and I's weekly show, the Pick of the Week show. We talk about each week's new comic books. We have our Talksplode interview show where Josh interviews a creator. That's the companion piece to this show. It alternates months, although not this month. They're both coming out in May because of scheduling. We have our monthly Media Explode, where Josh and I and our original co-host Ron Richards get together, talk about non-comics media, special edition shows, all kinds of stuff happening. It's all at ifanboy.com. You can find all of our shows there. There's nearly 1,400 of them over these 20 years.
Yeah. Well, not quite, but
19 years?
19.
19 years of doing shows.
18 and a half right now, but before you know it. I mean, I don't know when you're listening to this person at home with ears.
Right. You could be listening to this 5 years after we recorded it.
Yeah.
We're in 24 years.
The good news, I can say, though, looking back, I think we've made it pretty evergreen. If you're listening to 5 years from now, we won't know. No, we just talked about stuff we said in the show. But either way, the content mostly, 99%, you're good.
Well, I enjoyed this reading and I enjoyed talking to you about this, Josh, and I hope you enjoyed Absolutely. It as well. And until next time, I'm Connor.
I'm Josh. Thank you, Stan's boy. To go back and like read a specific, it sounds like it's wrong to say, right? But I think it's okay. This makes me want to go back and read specific sections of the Sean Howe History of Marvel book. I want to go through this part.
I'd like to reread that book in general.
Yes, it's great.
I would also like to, I think I'd like to go back and reread the Invaders comics. Maybe there's a collection of that we could do for a book.
I have them. They're all downstairs. They're ragged as shit, but I have every one of them.
When I was a kid at Big Apple Comic Con, I bought, well, my dad bought, but a giant stack. You know, like some dealer had like, you know, buy 20 for 10 bucks or whatever. And I bought like a giant stack of Invaders books. I just read over and over and over again.
Are we still doing the show?
Oops.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud. Sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it. You know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing. You should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.